Graham Allen Reel 4.
Well, there was this ship with these Ehrlichans, and I was one of the mids who was appointed to have his action station on the starboard side and control one of these guns. All very ad hoc. I'd never met the two seamen who were on the gun before, but it didn't make much difference. And Midshipman Tribe was with the commander down below. I might say that when the ship was sunk, the commander and Midshipman Tribe were lost. And I was on the upper deck and was able to survive. So it was one of these blows of fate. I often think of young Tribe, and these days, it's, well, now and again, you know, it comes through one's mind, and poor devil. Because I know the captain, the commander, was last seen trying to make the rudders work, so no doubt he was down below in the rudder flat and didn't have a chance when the ship went over. However, let's press on. Japanese, of course, had seen the Prince of Wales in Repulse quite early on the morning of December the 10th. And so as we had been seen, there was no cause for radio silence any longer. You only keep radio silence, after all, to hide your position from the enemy. But Admiral Phillips did not send an enemy sighting report because, we understand, he did not want to have his actions controlled from London. He didn't want anybody in the Admiralty in London telling him what to do. He thought he could do it himself. He was going to cover himself in glory. He didn't even tell Singapore that where he was, or even get back to within range of fighters, because he didn't have any time for the Air Force anyway, and he thought that the Navy could always do better. In fact, a clearer case of hubris you cannot imagine. Anyway, he did not make any sighting report. In fact, he never made a sighting report. The only sighting report, enemy sighting report, made was made by Captain Tennant of the Repulse, who did it on his own initiative, knowing that nothing had been sent, and eventually he decided to do it himself when he saw that the Prince of Wales was in such a bad way. So battle ensued. These Japanese planes came towards us, and of course they did exactly the right thing. They spread out all around the horizon, and they all turned together and all came from all different directions.
Did you see them?
Oh yes, you could see them over there, and of course the guns were blazing, but there were just so many of them, and they were in all different directions, and you only had, I think you had 4 5.25 turrets on either side, 8 5.25s, which was quite a formidable lot. But you see, they were all controlled. You couldn't control each one separately because they couldn't see. They had to be controlled from a central controller, you see. And they put up a great barrage, but that's all it was. It was a barrage, you see, and ships got planes got through. And I think we survived. Well, the battle's been well described. But I do remember the first time we were hit, and that was the port after screw, which did all the damage. Again, a fault in the design, and that those outer screws were too vulnerable, but the propeller shaft was bent by the explosion, and then it whipped around, tearing out the watertight glands as it went through, and flooding the whole of the port after quarter of the engine room and dump boiler room, and creating enormous vibration which shook all the electrics off the board, and caused a complete failure of electric power. This meant the ship took a serious list to port, and there was no power to drive the anti-aircraft guns, which of course were hydraulic powered, driven by electric motors, driving pumps. The ship having the 525 turrets were quite large and could be operated by hand, but not on a slope. I mean, on the level they could, with quite hard work, but you could train them around by hand. But when the ship was listing heavily, it was quite impossible. So that one torpedo put out all the anti-aircraft guns and gave the ship an enormous list of port. Soon after that, there was attacks continued, and I remember we were shooting at everything in sight. And I remember looking down in the water and seeing a row of bubbles, just like the book said, you might say. The row of bubbles coming straight towards the ship underneath where I stood. And I thought, oh my God, I have read that when Chatland or somewhere, you know, when torpedo hits, then vast amounts of broken steel go up in the air and come showering down. Well, certainly that column of water went up and it came down right on top of us. We've all soaked the skin, but luckily no steel, just water. And it was soon after that that we heard the order to abandon ship. The
what was your instant reaction then? I mean, you've been trained in what to do if that yes. was a change.
Well, you knew that things would, well, things could hardly be. We knew we would. The situation was getting more and more desperate, and of course, before we sank, the Repulse sank, and I remember seeing. The Pulse must have been about 2 miles, just 3 miles away. And seeing her, she dodged the torpedoes remarkably well until, of course, they got her in the end. And her bow came up slowly, you know, and the whole ship turned over and vanished. It was a horrifying sight, you know. I mean, even 3 miles away to see this great thing. However, the escorting destroyers, the Express... was one of them, and the captain of the Express brought his ship alongside the starboard quarter of the Prince of Wales and put a rope across so that the Prince of Wales, which was then going ahead about 8 knots, he put a rope across and grappling and other ropes, and so people could get across to the destroyer, and a lot of people did. Some people went hand over hand. But I thought, well, that looks a bit dicey to me because, in the first place, if the Prince of Wales goes over, all those ropes are going to break. And so you'll be in the water. You'll be dashed against the ship's side. Secondly, I thought, I remember distinctly regretting that I hadn't taken more... be more energetic at gym, because I did fancy myself going on a rope hand over hand across this chasm, as some people were doing, because I didn't feel I was quite hearty enough for that. So I went down a rope and I thought I'll swim across. But between the two ships, of course, there was about 10, 12 feet between the side of the Prince of Wales and the destroyer. And at the stern of the destroyer, on its port quarter, facing the Prince of Wales, they put down a scrambling net, big net. And I knew that I had to swim across this gap. But, of course, there was a torrent of water going down the gap. And I knew also that I had one chance. You know, if I missed that scrambling net, you know, that was it. Well, I swam like I'd never swum before, and I made it. There are some people, I say, were on the Encounter Express, quite dry, having just, but I didn't mind being wet. I no sooner got on board the Express than the Prince of Wales started to heave over. The captain of the Express backed off, cast off all the ropes, backed off quickly, and one saw the whole of the underside of the ship suddenly exposed, with men on it. And I thought, you know, I'd seen pictures of, I think it was the German ship Blücher at the Battle of Jutland, which had turned over just like that. And I thought to myself as a boy, having seen that, what a terrible situation to be in. And, you know, then I was watching the same thing myself at the same time. You know, it was quite extraordinary. The Express was overloaded with men and turned back to Singapore.
There were a lot of men in the water.
Men in the water. They picked up all they could. The Express was... The destroyers did wonders, I mean, to pick up everybody they could. certainly the ship I was in was very, very loaded. And of course, no sooner we turned back to Singapore than a flight of Brewster Buffaloes came over from Singapore. Japanese, of course, having all gone home by now. And of course, there was a great jeer from all the ratings on board, you see. But of course, it wasn't their fault. They had known in Singapore that something was going on, but they didn't know what. They didn't know where the... They had a very limited range. They couldn't find... they didn't know where to go. They didn't know what was happening. And it wasn't until they got this enemy report and the position from the Repulse that they knew where to go. And they were scrambled, and of course they came too late, you see. But it wasn't their fault. I mean, it was just that Phillips did not want any help from them, from the Air Force. Thank you. He could do better himself. So Phillips drowned and saved himself, I think, from being court-martialed. I hope so. Perhaps Churchill wouldn't have had any court-martialed, but Phillips drowned and a lot of better men, and Captain Leach was drowned also. He was a fine man, a fine man.
A great loss of life, then.
At least half the ship's company in both cases, yes. I forget what the figures were, but great loss of life, yes. Not many midshipmen lost, only two.
Really?
Yeah, only two of about 15 or so.
Yeah,
only two.
The atmosphere going back on the express, you went back to Singapore.
That's right, we went back to Singapore, and of course, there was a great state of shock. I think you can say that everybody in the Prince of Wales who had, certainly all the ship's company, really had thought themselves, I'd say in Britain's latest and greatest battleship, and suddenly to realise that we'd been so ignominiously defeated in such an unexpected and thorough way. And we were all lucky to survive. The great thing was shock, I think. It really was. As opposed to later, you see, when I was sunk in the Exeter, when everybody knew that we were 99% certain of being sunk, there was no shock. People sort of thought, oh, good, we're alive, but... it wasn't the same atmosphere as it was during when the Prince of Wales went down.
Yeah. What was it like arriving back in Singapore?
Well, they did. It was all that I can remember now is I remember seeing Midshipman Leach talking to somebody, being told by some officer that his father had not survived. I remember seeing that, and just a lot of people milling about. And we were eventually, I think, given some food and. Given a cabin, a room, and I was, I remember finding myself in a bed. There was a bed and clean sheets, and finding myself in this, and I think to myself, my God, I'm never so lucky to be alive, so astonished to be alive. But after that, we were, I think, the next day. HMS Exeter came into Singapore, and all of the, it was decided by whoever, that all the midshipmen should go back in HMS Exeter to Colombo, where we were given some survivor's leave. And we were made very welcome in Colombo, and we were there over Christmas, where we were given hospitality by the English community there. And we had a very nice holiday with, tennis, girls, and everybody very, very nice to us. All very incredulous, about the Prince of Wales and Repulse. However, we didn't know, of course, what would happen to us. But, as luck would have it, the Exeter had a complement of midshipmen, about 10 or 12, who had all done their official 20 months at sea. And the normal procedure then was after you'd done 20 months as a midshipman, you then went back to Portsmouth, to Whale Island and other establishments, to do your sub-lieutenant's courses. More training. And then you'd be fledged as a sub-lieutenant and go to sea. So all the mids in the Exeter were due to go home. How convenient. They all got shipped home, and this batch of spare mids from the Prince of Wales were moved into the Exeter, which we thought was a very raw deal indeed, because whereas the Prince of Wales had a certain degree of comfort being a battleship, and you know, we all knew it, there we were in a completely new ship, new officers, new seamen, a much more old-fashioned ship, and it was what was called a cut-down county. The county-class cruisers were Norfolk and Suffolk and Devonshire and Dorsetshire, but they, because of the treaty limitations, they had also built two cut-down versions with only 3 8-inch turrets instead of 4. You see, there were two ahead, two in four, and there's only one on the quarter thing. So that meant that the whole accommodation was very much restricted, and so we were very, very uncomfortable in the ship. We were terribly cramped. And so we thought this was a very poor exchange indeed. Well, I said that the survivors of the Prince of Wales were in a state of shock, and I think that we midshipmen also were. We didn't really regard it as such, but in spite of the fact we'd had a break in Colombo, which had been nice, there's no doubt that we didn't enjoy our time in the Exeter, because the, as a different ship's company, different officers, some of whom were not at all sympathetic to our position, who compared us unfavourably with a previous lot of mids, who of course had been in the ship since it had, since it had recommissioned, who knew their way around, who were useful members of the ship's company, whereas we were completely brand new to this particular ship. And no use saying this isn't how we did it in the Prince of Wales, because that's the last thing they wanted to hear, you see. But so altogether, we weren't all that pleased with being in the ship, and it was too bad.
It sounds as though there was a bit of an attitude towards you, you know, that you'd been on the ship Prince of Wales, and one might have suspected that taking on a load of people whose last ship had recently sunk, you know, there might be a more sympathetic attitude, but it seems to be the reverse.
Well, it didn't. I think it was not a great deal of sympathy, shall we say. You know, that here you are in this ship and you've got to knuckle down to, which of course we did, but people were not too happy about it. It wasn't a very jolly ship. Of course, we knew that we were on a hiding to nothing, that things were getting worse and worse. So we spent our, we did go to Colombo again and back to Singapore. And meanwhile, the Japanese, of course, were making great inroads down Malaya. And we found ourselves in Java and in the Batavia, as it then was. On the day that Singapore fell, February the 15th, it was decided that one should show the flag, make some demonstration. Now, there was the Exeter and some Encounter and Express, some destroyers, and there was the Houston, which was a American Navy, there was the Perth, the Australian Navy cruiser, the Perth, and the some Dutch ships, the De Ruyter and the Van Tromp, was it? I forget, but it was a very heterogeneous force called ABDA, I think it was, Australia, Britain, Dutch and American ABDA force. But it was a very, very scratch. And you see, it had had no chance to knit itself together. There was no agreed system of communication. There was no signals procedure, which was universal between them all. And altogether, it was very much just a collection of ships. There wasn't a fleet, actually. And this was quite unable to resist the Japanese. Well, on the day the Singapore fell, it was decided that we would show the flag, and the fleet set out to up the Straits of the Straits of just to the east of Sumatra. You go my geography, sorry. Well, we went up through these beautiful tropical islands with palm fringed shores on either side, brilliant day, and heading towards Singapore. We had good radar, and we detected about 90 miles away, we could detect incoming Japanese bombers. And the Japs attacked us with high-level bombers all through the day. And the procedure was quite regular. The ships were all spread out. You'd detect the Japs coming over about 90 miles. You would all gaze into the sky with binoculars, and there were some binoculars on pedestals so that you could read the bearing and elevation. And you'd know roughly where to, you'd know the direction to look, and you'd suddenly spot them, these silver shapes in the sky, coming straight towards you. And quite surprising, really, that you didn't see them until they were quite close. I mean, you could see them, sometimes they'd be quite close before you see them, comparatively close, perhaps, you know, 10 miles. Whereas you've been detecting them a long way away, and they seem to be quite large. However, you'd then watch them carefully, and the bearing and elevation would be reported to the guns. The guns would open fire, the anti-aircraft guns, and then you'd watch them, and you'd see the black oblong underneath which the bomb bays were open. And then you'd watch, and you'd see the first man to see the bombs come out. You see the bombs gone. You see, at that, of course, the captain would then put the helm over one way or the other, and you'd do a. You're doing quite fast, you see, and you'd do a hard turn, the whole ship would heel over, and you'd hope that you'd gone the right way, and they haven't foreseen it. And I remember the whole of that day, planes came over. Oh, many times. None of us was hit. It shows the effect of high-level bombing. It's very difficult to hit ships down below, whereas low-level bombing with torpedoes is another matter altogether, you see. We had one triumph, I must say, one triumph. The gunnery officer, who went on to distinguish himself later in life as a very fine vice admiral, the gunnery officer was very keen to try his 8-inch guns as anti-aircraft guns. Now, these, of course, are big guns, 8-inch, you see, and not for anti-aircraft. But they did have a supply of explosive shells controlled by a fuse. So he got ready with the captain and said, okay, and the front guns, the four guns, were cocked up at maximum elevation, and we knew what height these planes were coming in. The fuse was set, and so the whole thing was set really so that when the next lot of planes came over, they'd fly into the spot at which the guns were aiming. And so when they went off, of course, it nearly blew us off the bridge. I mean, with these guns high, it really was so, but it's tremendous boom. And we watched carefully, and it was quite amazing that I must say that from my limited memory now, there was a great blast of black smoke in the sky, and I couldn't detect any planes anymore. Whether it blew them all out of the sky, I just don't know, but I think it certainly got a lot of them. It was most successful, and it was the most successful use of 8-inch guns, but it's not something you would usually do, you see. But it was all perfect conditions, you see. You would see it all. The Japs were coming in steady, and they just flew into it. So that, and then we went back to Surabaya or Batavia. Singapore fell, and of course, nothing we could do about it. The ships were in the Java Sea, the Admiral force within the Java Sea, and the Japanese, of course, came down towards Java by the end of February. And I think it was the February the 27th or 28th, I forget. And there was the Battle of the Java Sea, which of course the Japanese won. They were a well-knit, organized force. The Dutch distinguished themselves very well. They were all lost. The Houston and the Perth tried to get away, but they were sunk in the Sunda Straits. And not many survivors from either of those. Altogether, it was a pretty good shambles. And the Exeter was hit. The Exeter was hit in one of its main steam pipes. And we got back to Surabaya. We got back under half speed to Surabaya.
Where were you during this action?
My action station was on air defence. I was one of these young officers who had both have good eyesight, and I, when we'd been attacked in the Straits. I say by this high-level bombing, I was one of those who was trying to spot the enemy as early as possible, to get our guns on them as early as possible. So really, it was an air defence position. But in the case of a sea battle, there was much less for one to do. One just really, was there. One just couldn't do very much. And I don't remember any particular thing about that.
So we then
got to Surabaya and had to repair as best we could, bury those who had been killed, and we then had orders that we were to go back, we were to break out and go back to Colombo via the Java Sea and the Sunda Straits, which of course may have been the only thing we could do. There wasn't a great deal of water between Lombok and Bali for us to get out that way to go to Australia, but the powers that be decided that was the way we had to go, which was going right across the bowels of the enemy, right through the Java Sea, and out through the Sunda Straits. So the chance of getting away, everyone knew, was absolutely zero. So we left that night in company with the USS Pope, which was an old four-stacker, and and HMS Encounter, a British destroyer. And we met the Japanese in the middle of the Java Sea at about, I don't know, 8 or 9 in the morning, soon after. And that's when things got interesting. We had... The Japs were all around the place, and they were not going to offer themselves up as targets if they could help it, because why should they? We were the only resistance in thousands of miles, so there was no need for them to risk anything, really. They could just pick us off at their leisure. So the battle started, and you could see masts coming up over the horizon, you see. It was a lovely clear day. And the captain was calling up to the lookout in the crow's nest, you see. Now, the lookout in the crow's nest was an ordinary seaman who was a Glaswegian and who was under considerable stress because he realized that he didn't want to be up there and he was obviously a bit apprehensive. So his Glaswegian accent got broader and broader, and the captain said, "I can't understand what he said. Go up there," he said to me, "and make a bit of sense, you see. So get up the crow's nest." So I said, "Aye, aye, sir," and I scramble up the ladder to the crow's nest. I remember thinking, Exeter had a tripod mast, and looking at this, they were quite solid, and I thought, well, if one of those is shot away, the other two will probably be okay, you see. So I got up there to this ordinary seaman, and as soon as the gun started, he said, "Can we go down now?" I said, "No fear, you will stay where you are." Stay where you are. And I was reporting, ship over starboard 15, wherever they're coming up. There were an awful lot of them, you see, so it didn't help the captain very much. You had another enemy somewhere else. So the ship was fought as best it could, and we avoided avoided any hits until very near, until we had nearly run out of ammunition. Really, we'd fired pretty well everything we had. And as it happened, a salvo came aboard and cut off the last of the steam, and so the ship was out of action.
Graham Allen, end of reel 4.